Hi, today we're going to talk about the truth, how we can find the truth, what the truth is, and how we go about determining it, and how finding the truth can help you, help set you free from the chains of illusion. I'm going to start with talking about social, political truths and metaphysical truth. It all sounds kind of complicated, but let's take it from a very accessible point, from Plato's Allegory of the Cave. Plato wrote this book called The Republic, and in it, Socrates, the main protagonist, tells his listeners about this cave. It's a famous piece of philosophy, the Allegory of the Cave. So, basically, the story is, let's imagine that there are a bunch of prisoners, and they're all chained up near the wall of this cave. And behind them are a bunch of people walking with various objects, and vases and flowers and what have you. And nearby there's a fire, and the fire causes the shadows of these objects to be cast on the wall of the cave. That's all the prisoners can see, is the shadows on the wall, and so that's all they see for their whole lives. So they end up discussing these shadows and talking about them amongst themselves, and making theories about the shadows and which ones come after which other ones and what they mean and who these people are, or what these forces are that create the shadows, and are they gods, or and what do they mean, and so on, and what are our obligations towards the shadows and towards the creators of those shadows. So you can just imagine, right, the questions and theories that people might come up with. This was the time of the Greeks and the Greek myths. So now let's imagine that one of the prisoners manages to escape from his chains one day and starts walking away from the wall and towards the entrance to the cave. He then sees these people carrying these objects and sees the fire, and then he has an aha moment. Aha! So this is what it's all about. And he has a higher level of understanding of the truth. And then he says, well, let me see what else I can see here, and starts walking further towards the mouth of the cave. Eventually he gets to the entrance to the cave and actually walks out and is initially blinded by the sunlight. And eventually, after blinking his eyes, he sees the light. And now he's seen the highest level of truth and understands how objects appear and what objects he's been seeing all his life and what objects his friends and compatriots have been seeing. So then he decides, well, I think I'll go back into the cave and tell my fellow prisoners the truth, and they'll be very happy to be enlightened and freed from their chains too, their chains of illusion. So he heads back into the cave and encounters these prisoners and tells them what he's discovered, expecting that they're all going to be very happy and rejoice. But instead they are very unhappy that their world has been shattered, and decide that they will kill him, which they go ahead and do. Sad story. So through this allegory of the cave, Plato is trying to illustrate the position that we find ourselves in through in relation to the truth, and how there are different levels of truth. He defined the lowest level as the level of mere opinion, or doxa in Greek, and then a higher understanding would be doxa aletheia, which means true opinion. And then as we go to higher levels of truth, it has episteme, the kind of knowledge, and then the very highest level of truth is aletheia, or absolute truth. So without going into all the details of Plato's theories, we get the general idea of how he illustrates way back when, more than 2,000 years ago, how people were caught up in social truths and lies, and this prevented them from understanding and achieving greater understanding. Now, are things that much different today? I don't know. We could look at this allegory and think about the prisoners of the cave as us, or the people, for example, in the movie The Matrix, who live in a computer-generated world, and they don't understand that they are living in a fake world, in a virtual world. How do you break free of that if you're caught up in the illusion of a imaginary world? Good question, right? So we find today that there are people who believe in all sorts of theories and conspiracy theories about the world, which in general we would consider not to be true. There are still people who believe in the flat earth, and then there are people who believe in all sorts of conspiracy theories, that the moon landing never happened, for example, or that the 9/11 terrorist attack was actually created by Bush and Cheney and his buddies. It wasn't really the result of Osama bin Laden and his cohorts. Funnily enough, I was in Woodstock, New York on 9/11, and when I first saw this, that's what occurred to me. I thought, geez, this must be some kind of plot by Bush and Cheney to improve their odds and to make themselves more popular. Just like Margaret Thatcher had used war to boost her own rankings in the in England back in the early 80s, her popularity was waning very rapidly. And then the Argentinians took over the Falklands, which they call the Malvinas, and eventually a war broke out. But there was a time when they were kind of, it was a standoff, and the British had their ships in one place and the Argentinians had their ships in another place. And then at some point the British decided to sink this Argentinian ship called the General Belgrano. 500 people were killed as the ship went down. So the Sun newspaper, which is a conservative right-wing popular newspaper, which is famous for its page 3 pictures of naked women and famous for its adherence to conservative party policies, published their headline. It was just one word: gotcha. And this was very popular amongst the English, who also been going through some difficult times with inflation and depression and a lot of strikes going on previously. People were feeling maybe that England wasn't doing so well. They were trying to find a way to make England great again. And here came Margaret Thatcher, being very macho, and sinking this Argentinian ship, which led to the Falklands War, which cost the British huge amounts of money. They said they were doing it to save the Falklands and to keep them English and to protect the people living on the Falklands. It ended up costing millions of dollars per person on the Falklands to maintain it as an English settlement. Anyway, going back to the question of 9/11, and one examines the evidence and examines the findings of the people who explored the evidence and so on, it seems pretty likely that it was caused by these terrorists who came from Saudi Arabia, mostly, and were inspired by Osama bin Laden, not by Bush and Cheney, despite the fact that that would have been a very clever move on their part. But, and there are various other conspiracy theories that float around, especially around the 9/11 issue, the number 7 World Trade Center. The building sort of collapsed in a particular way, so a lot of people say that that's because it was a controlled explosion. not because the building had been designed from the beginning that if it did meet a terrible accident of some sort, it would collapse in a particular way. But anyway, so we can go into talk about more modern, more current conspiracy theories. During the Trump-Clinton election in 2016, some rumors arose about Clinton and her staff and people associated with the Clinton campaign that they were running some kind of pedophile ring in the basement of a pizza bar in Washington, D.C. A number of people started believing that this was true, and one guy in particular traveled from South Carolina all the way to Washington, D.C. with a shotgun and came into this pizza bar and started shooting the place up, killing several people. This is all based on his understanding of, quote-unquote, the truth. So, more recently, something came along called QAnon theory, which is based on some conspiracy theory that there's a guy called Q who was releasing information, especially during the Trump years, from the administrative sections of the government, what they call the deep state, parts of the government that does not change when a new administration comes around. And he was releasing this information about what's really going on and about pedophiles running the government and God knows what. Pretty bizarre stuff. And his name is Q for some strange reason. That's all. And his name has never been truly revealed. And there are now literally millions of people in the United States who believe this stuff and call themselves QAnon theorists. And many of them were involved in the insurrection on January 6, 2020 at the Capitol building, Washington, D.C., where they stormed the building and tried to take over the government and threatened to hang Vice President Pence if he didn't play ball with them and declare the election to be invalid and declare Trump to be the true winner. So these... And there are many people who believe in this. And this is not new, of course. We know about other situations. One of the most famous being Goebbels, who in Nazi Germany in the 30s managed to convince lots of people that the problems of Germany were all down to a group of Jews who had conspired with international forces against Germany. And that was the reason that Germany wasn't doing well. And all one had to do was to fight these this Jewish conspiracy, get rid of the Jews, and have a nice little war, and everything would be fine. And we've seen pictures of Goebbels and talking about it, and to huge masses of people screaming total war, and people applauding and cheering. Of course, afterwards, no one admits to being one of those people who were fully behind Goebbels. I imagine in years to come it will be hard to find anyone who admits to having been a QAnon supporter and even perhaps a Trump supporter. Same sort of thing happened in South Africa where I grew up, that you had to be careful about what you said and who you said it to. I realized this while I was still in school, in high school, around about the age of 12. Someone gave me a book by Bertrand Russell called Why I'm Not a Christian, which really set me on the path of philosophy and questioning what is taken to be true by many people in the population. So I'd never been very religious, or my parents had not been either, but I was aware that the Christianity was used by the government as a means to justify its apartheid policies. So this book was really quite revolutionary to me to read about why Christianity is a sort of fake and why God is a ridiculous idea. And so I then started talking about this to my friends at school and arguing with a lot of the teachers and getting various kinds of pushback from them. Although there was one teacher who greatly encouraged me. But that's another long story. How she was also hounded by the government in subsequent years for running a place called Volksbrett, where they had encounter groups where blacks were allowed to attend as well as white people. We had white people and black people getting together and hugging one another and having Rogerian-style counter groups. And but anyway, so going back to my school days in South Africa, that one could get into a lot of trouble for questioning the government. In fact, she got into a lot of trouble for questioning the government too, and she had to leave. She and her husband had to leave South Africa and live in exile. So we did finally meet up in London in the 1970s, funnily enough. So in these days, there are so many examples of dictators and such people, authoritarian leaders, trying to control the press and trying to control the television stations and any kind of information system that's out there, to try to control people's minds and control what they think. Right at the moment, we have this war going on with the Russians and the Ukrainians, where the Russians are basically taking over parts of Ukraine and killing people, threatening them to get their way, and they're claiming at home it's not a war, it's just a sort of mopping up operation where they're getting rid of some Nazis, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever, because the leader of Ukraine is a Jew himself, and it just doesn't make sense. And the Russians are then claiming locally that they are helping the people in Ukraine, not conducting a war. And in these authoritarian climates, people living in these countries, sometimes one says, well, why do they let these people get away with it? Why do the Hungarians let Viktor Orban get away with it? Why do the people in Saudi Arabia let Prince, whatever his name is, and Salman, the guy who was responsible for the killing of that journalist Khashoggi in Turkey, why do they let him get away with it? That in these countries, questioning the prevailing truth can be very dangerous and can lead to being beaten up or imprisoned or even executed. This is again the situation that I found myself in South Africa. So to some extent, when I was younger, I questioned a lot of truth and kicked up a lot of dirt. But in subsequent years, you start thinking about it and you start wondering, if I continue this and I'm too successful at this, maybe I'll end up in John Forster Square, which was a famous police station in Johannesburg, where several people were ejected from the windows. There's a guy, Ahmed Timol, one of the early ones, who was mysteriously found on the street outside the building. They said, oh no, he'd fallen out of the sixth floor window. And then there were several others after that who were mysteriously defenestrated. And and then there were many others who were imprisoned for long periods of time, and others who died in detention, and some who were executed for their revolutionary beliefs and revolutionary acts. So there were all sorts of questions that one could ask about how one helps the population understand truth when they're actually operating, as far as we can see, under an illusion. And we could go on for many, many hours or days talking about such things, about Lenin, Mandela, various people who have tried to help people understand the truth in difficult situations. These issues that I'm mentioning all go under the category of social or political truths. We also have the situation with personal truths. What do I see? What do I understand? What do I believe in terms of my personal world? Here we could investigate all sorts of methodologies that have come around, and especially since the 1960s, but going back quite some way, people have been presenting methods of finding out the truth. We could take, within the realm of psychotherapy, we can start with Freud. In a sense, the father of psychoanalysis, the father of psychotherapy. And let's look at what he did and how he started the ball rolling in terms of presenting a method of finding out the truth for oneself, and why that's important. So to recap a bit on what's been said up to now, so far I've been talking mostly about philosophical truth. These are more general truths that apply to all of us, to apply to the world, and to ourselves. And going from Plato and Aristotle through people like Augustine and on to Descartes, Hume, Spinoza, and Kant and Hegel and others, we've done a great job of discussing truth and how one arrives at truth and what the nature of truth is and so on. But this is mostly done from a generalized perspective, not from the perspective of an individual human being so much. What I like about Plato's example of the cave is it includes a kind of social aspect, that these prisoners are together as a social unit, and they discuss the so-called truths that they perceive. And even though it's only one guy who actually manages to escape initially, we can see them as a social group and understand, perhaps like the Matrix, issues like conspiracy theories and generalized group theories, which we all know about. If you think about it, everybody used to think that the world was flat until it was discovered otherwise. It was generally believed that the Earth was the center of the universe until Galileo and Bruno, Copernicus, showed otherwise. So, and that was again through scientific truths, and we haven't actually talked that much about science, because I see it again as a generalized form of truth, and what we want to get to next is a more like a personalized view of truth, what is true to us personally and socially. So one of the philosophers who discussed social truths and made a huge revolution in philosophy itself was Karl Marx, who in the 19th century put forward his theories of communism and capital to show how we are all influenced by money in a certain way. Again, Marx is unusual in that he discusses money and economics as part of his discussion of philosophy. Most philosophers don't mention such things as money. Until we get to maybe the 20th century, where philosophers like Levinas do talk about money to some extent and material possessions and things like that as important aspects of our world and our truths and what we perceive as truth and what concerns us, what limitations we have in our society and how we can overcome them, if at all. But going on now to personal truths, let's look at the history of psychology and psychotherapy from the beginning of the 20th century. Here again we can distinguish between different trends or different streams of thought in terms of how do we find out the truths about an individual person's psychology, about their mind, about their world. So first of all, let's look at psychoanalysis as the example of a very personalized view of truth. Let's look at psychoanalysis as a way of delving into personal truths. Psychoanalysis was first developed by Sigmund Freud around 1900 with the release of his book Interpretation of Dreams, where he showed that we can analyze a person's dreams, help them analyze their dreams themselves, I should say, to help them understand themselves better and help them relieve themselves of hang-ups, what Freud called neuroses. He actually began his work dealing with what they called at that time conversion hysterics. These were people who had some kind of physical disability, like a paralyzed arm, but there was no visible physical or neurological cause of that paralysis. So Freud showed using hypnosis that you could have someone explore their own history to bring up repressed thoughts and impulses. So for example, one woman had a paralyzed arm, and through hypnosis, Freud helped her discover that she'd had these murderous impulses towards her sister, and she had in turn repressed those thoughts as being too horrific for herself to bear. She couldn't stand to think that she could have such impulses. And so the result was this paralyzed arm, which was a way of preventing herself from actually striking a blow against her sister. But it was an actual impediment to the act, or a symbolic impediment. We can't say for sure, but it could very well be both. So through this woman realizing what the reason was for her paralyzed arm, she was able to free herself of that impediment and move on with her life. Now, this was a particularly radical example of repression and freedom from repression. So Freud subsequently got into a method called, he called free association, where somebody would lie on a couch and simply say whatever came to mind during a session, and he would, of course, encourage them to talk about their dreams, and he would then try to help them understand their unconscious motivations for various acts in the world that they weren't necessarily aware of. He was very good initially also at showing sort of slips of the tongue, what he called parapraxis. One woman came to him, she'd been newly married, and started talking about how she was walking down the street with a friend, and she saw her husband on the other side of the street, and she said to her friend, "Oh, look, there goes Mr. X." And then she sort of, her friend said, "No, that's your husband, isn't it?" And then she was sort of suddenly reminded, "Oh, yes, that's my husband." And Freud thought, geez, when he heard that story, that it wasn't a good sign of how the marriage would proceed and whether things would work out very well with that marriage. So the idea of slips of the tongue is now a very commonly used expression in our language and in our thought and everyday life. These ideas were introduced by Freud. So we could go on talking a lot about Freud and about his concepts and how he developed these ideas of the ego, the id, and the superego, and how they all interacted with one another, and his thoughts about the Oedipus complex and about childhood sexuality. Some of these things are quite controversial. Some of them are still accepted by a lot of psychoanalysts, and many and or most have been modified or gone over time and time again in the years since Freud. Freud had a circle called the Psychoanalytic Circle in Vienna, and many of the members of that group then branched out later on to have their own theories, which were tended to be based on the basic principles of psychoanalysis, but differed from Freud in many ways. So you had Jung, who took after Freud, but like to think about spiritual aspects as being part of a person's makeup, and things like synchronicity, which were events where, for example, you think of someone and then the phone rings immediately after you think of them, and events like that. I once had a friend who was a twin, and she said, "I must cut my hair today," and then she found out that her twin in South Africa had also cut her hair that same day. And she felt like this was a meaningful, synchronous event. And then there were people like Otto Rank and Ferenczi. And Then there was a man called Wilhelm Reich, who developed a theory which was considered very radical, called the orgasmic theory. He wrote a book called The Function of the Orgasm, and he said that he observed people on the couch that are talking in the psychoanalytic method, and he noticed that they tended to be, that their pelvises and their bodies were very stiff and rigid until they freed themselves of many of their hang-ups. And so he thought, well, geez, well, wouldn't this be a good idea to actually help them free their bodies at the same time as freeing their minds? And so he developed methods of working with people to help them free their pelvises and the rest of their bodies from tensions and suppressed feelings at the same time as talking to them and discussing their issues with them. Freud actually was horrified with this idea, and Reich was thrown out of the group, but he continued doing his work in Germany. He also, Reich was also unusual in that he took into account a lot of social factors in people's neuroses and their hang-ups in life. So he wrote a book on fascism and another book called Listen, Little Man, which were aimed at people who were who had succumbed to fascism, which was growing very rapidly in those days in Germany. Reich, fortunately, was able to get out of Germany before the Nazis came and moved to the United States, where he continued doing his work, some of which was quite controversial in other ways. But Reich's basic ideas of you can free the body at the same time as freeing the mind were incorporated by many subsequent therapists who, especially in the 60s and 70s, with the flourishing of the New Age movement, where you had all sorts of therapies that worked on the body as well as the mind. These therapies worked on the body as well as the mind at the same time, because therapists believed that this was a better way and a quicker way of helping people free themselves from their hang-ups. So you had, for example, bioenergetics, started by a man called Alexander Lowen, who had been a student of Reich's, and then many other therapies which worked on the body and the mind at the same time, like Reiki and Rolfing, and many, many other variations on body-mind work, as it came to be called. There have also been other streams in psychotherapy based on different thought systems, different philosophies, if you will. There's, for example, the existential movement, which started with people like Binswanger and were developed later on by many others, including R.D. Lang, who I was fortunate to study with personally, and people like David Cooper and others. Lang wanted to look at the human being as a whole, not as a conglomeration of theoretical constructs like the ego, the id, the superego, or even Melanie Klein's concepts involving the good breast and the bad breast and split-off objects and so on. Not that he didn't think that those concepts could sometimes be useful, but he wanted to find a better way of interacting with his patients so that he could work with them and help them discover for themselves their own truths. So Lang's first book is called The Divided Self, and in that book he talks about how people are influenced by their society and by their families, and for some people who are classified as schizophrenics, they become split off from themselves because of societal and family pressures. Lang was particularly focusing on people labeled as schizophrenics, people who in radical ways had to struggle with trying to reconcile their view of themselves on the one hand and a view imposed upon them by others, by the family or by the society. He was influenced by someone he'd trained with, a guy called Winnicott, who had done a lot of work on with children and had a great book called Playing in Reality, which is well worth reading if you don't read anything else in psychoanalysis. Winnicott talked about the true self and the false self, and talked about how those two could be reconciled, hopefully. There's a very good article written by Winnicott called Ego Distortion in Terms of the True and False Self, in which he quite clearly lays out his ideas about the true and the false self. The false self being that self that's encouraged to be, well, fake by the environment or by the mother in order to satisfy something in the environment or to satisfy something about the mother. And the child is not allowed to express his or her own views and desires if it doesn't meet with the mother's expectations. We can see this happening in all sorts of situations where the parents have decided what the child is going to be and what they're going to like and what they're not going to like and so on. And if they don't live up to that, then the parent encourages them subtly or less subtly to take a particular path. This could lead to someone growing up with a false self that they have developed in order to hide their true intentions, their true being, as a way of gaining favor, gaining affection from the mother or the mother figure. And Winnicott speculates that a number of these people end up becoming actors because they're very good at hiding their true selves and putting on a fake front. He also goes on to talk about how some of these people who are afflicted by a split between the true and the false self are unable to ever actually reconcile it and maybe end up committing suicide as a kind of misguided attempt to resolve the problem of the split between the true and the false self. By committing suicide, the subject eliminates both the true and false self and is free from further conflict. Lange went on to write another book called Self and Others, again exploring different operations that occur in particular individuals on from the social events that they encounter and the personal feelings and encounters that they have with themselves. So it's just called existential therapy because it avoids in general trying to go back to reductionist views of what happened in childhood and trying to develop a theory about someone's events that such and such happened to them, for example, in childhood, and therefore they became an XYZ type of person, and therefore the XYZ type of person behaves in such and such a way. This is quite a popular way of thinking, believe it or not, in this day and age, that people like to use categorizations to define what somebody is, as a as if they are defining types of vegetables or types of objects in physics. These type of analyses can be quite useful if one's trying to determine the chemical composition of a particular substance, and could also be useful in medicine sometimes. But in terms of understanding a human being, Lange thought that we were much greater beings than this and capable of change. And if you did define someone as an object, that was often the problem that they were encountering in the first place, that they'd been defined as an object and had been encouraged to see themselves as objects or false selves. So at this point, talking about seeing people as objects, we can also talk about other streams of theories in psychotherapy or psychology that also began around the beginning of the 20th century. So one important stream that has been around for a long time is behaviorism, where Skinner and initially a guy called Watson came up with these theories about how people are determined by events in their life. So you had a stimulus, which is an event in the real world, and then a response, which is the response of the organism to that event. And so you had you could then define, through experiments, certain actions in certain ways that sort of streams of behavior could be induced, especially in pigeons and in rats. And the experimentation often took place, using pigeons and rats and various other animals. Watson was followed by B.F. Skinner, who took behaviorism a step further and wanted to apply it to every type of situation and to human beings in the world. Skinner even thought that he could do this with children, and he took one of his own kids and put them in a Skinner box when they were born, where all stimulation and all kinds of interactions were limited in this kind of plastic igloo-type box that he created for the child, so that the child didn't get much hugging or interaction with other human beings or food, except when it was deemed appropriate for the experiment. Well, I feel very sorry for that child, and hopefully she wasn't too badly damaged by the experience. Behaviorism tended to continue in the United States in particular, and followed by people in other parts of the Western world, where it became a popular idea to understand human beings in that way, because people then argued that this was the scientific method. And if there is something that goes on in the 20th century that I find somewhat strange, is the worshipping of science as the only method of attaining truth. Of course, science is very powerful in many ways. It helps us define a particular methodology for understanding the world. And of course, we can see what science has done for us in the 20th century, and how it's helped develop better and better technology and better medicine, for example, and electric cars and spaceships and atomic bombs, not all of which are inventions that we are happy about, or that the developers of those inventions were necessarily happy about. But going back to psychology, many people thought that this was the method that should be used to understand people and to provide therapy, if you want to call it that, so that somebody would come along with a particular problem, say they have a fear of cats, then the behavioral therapist would then say, okay, they were conditioned somehow or another in their past experience to be fearful of cats, so let's try to see what we can do. And they would introduce a cat in a room, but very, very far away from the patient, and then give the patient soothing substances to make them feel good. And say, see, the cat doesn't attack you, and you're actually feeling good, right? And then gradually bring the cat closer and closer, closer to the patient, until eventually the patient's embedded conditioned responses are nullified, and the person can be freed of that particular response. So in some circumstances, these types of interventions, of course, can be useful. But as a general principle, as a general methodology for understanding a human being, they fall very short, especially in the sort of meta fact that a person has been treated as an object and not given any choice in the matter of what is going to happen to them and what should be conditioned or what should not be conditioned. Some people prefer this. I just want to go to the doctor or the therapist and let them do their work and let them fix me and condition me in the way that they feel is the best. So that's certainly not what I would choose, and I know a lot of other people who would not choose the same type of intervention. But behaviorism is now led to a new type of therapy that is very popular, called cognitive behavioral therapy, which combines the types of behaviorist principles and that I was just describing with talk therapy. And so one tries to use these behavioral techniques along with rational talk to help the person free themselves of hang-ups and behaviors which are self-defeating or creating problems in life for that particular person. So how do we relate these different trends in therapy to truth? Well, we can look at psychoanalysis and going through to the different types of psychoanalysis that were around, and we can see that these are all methods where the psychoanalyst tries to help the patient come to terms with their own truths and discover their truths themselves through free association and dream analysis and so on. The analyst should not be in a position of trying to impose their beliefs upon the patient about what the structures of consciousness are and what has caused the patient to be the way that they are in the present day. Then another trend that is the existential phenomenological method, like that of Lange's, which takes into account the patient's wider world and their feelings about themselves. Lange has a concept called ontological security, which really is the an idea about how secure one feels in one's world. And prefers to use that rather than some kind of reductionistic methodology to talk about how a person's consciousness was created from childhood trauma and so on. This doesn't mean that those issues are necessarily excluded. If it comes up during the therapy, that these issues can be dealt with and talked about and hopefully resolved, including, of course, sexual trauma and trauma resulting from abuse, whether that abuse is physical or mental. Then the other trend I spoke about, the behaviorist approach, tends to put a lot of trust and faith in the therapist to decide how to manipulate or change the person's psychological structures, their SR mechanisms, to create a new person that does not have certain behaviors or structures of behavior, or whatever you want to call it, streams of stimulus-response mechanisms. And then, of course, we need to talk about the truths of psychiatry, truths or otherwise. Psychiatry flourished in the West, particularly after the Second World War. R.D. Lange was a psychiatrist in the military. That was his first practice of psychiatry after he graduated in Scotland. And he described how really their function was to try to get people back into the front lines. They would get these soldiers and people who were complaining of issues and neuroses or problems. And the job of the psychiatrist was to try to work with them to, quote-unquote, fix them, heal them, and get them back into the front lines. If they weren't able to do that, then the person became a casualty of the war and had to be paid out in terms of a pension and so on. This is costly for the military. So psychiatrists were useful in that respect to help the get people back into the trenches, get them to be happy war fodder again. At some point, talking about Lange, he read Carl Rogers in the 1950s. Carl Rogers had developed a method of therapy which was about affirming people's utterances and affirming their positions in the world. So rather than trying to fix anybody, he would echo what they were saying and affirm them as far as possible in their utterances. So this became really one of the leading forms of what was called humanistic psychology or humanistic therapy. Lange was impressed by this idea that you could treat another human being in your care as a human being rather than as the object of a study or something, some kind of item that needs to be fixed, like a broken TV or other appliance. And so he actually moved his chair around from the one side of the desk to the other, sitting next to the patient, where he could talk more freely and more amicably to the person. One of his superiors saw him doing this and was shocked and reprimanded him, but Lange learned from this lesson himself and went on to develop a method which you could also call a humanistic method of listening to people and trying to understand them from their own point of view. Lange had a lot of experience with this and was very good at working, particularly with psychotic patients who other therapists could not deal with. Many other therapists would say, we can't deal with these people, they're gone and we can't communicate with them at all. So, for example, there was one woman who was diagnosed as a catatonic schizophrenic, and she was sitting in a corner of her ward and on her own and curled up in a fetal position and wasn't talking to anybody and hadn't talked to anybody for years. And Lange was invited in to consult about this woman. So he, and she was in fact naked. So he also took off all his clothes and went and sat next to her and just sat there saying nothing. And eventually she turned around and started talking to him. So Lange's methodology really involved something very simple, is actually relating to a human being as a human being and trying to understand where they were coming from, how they got to their experience, rather than analyzing the experience and saying it's good or bad, or it's he would try to understand why would I behave in the way this person is behaving, what would have to happen to me to want to sit in the corner of this room naked and not speak to anybody, what kind of trauma would I have had to have gone through to experience that. And through that kind of questioning, he would work with people and try to understand them, and he was very successful at it. However, general stream psychiatry became very pharmacological based around starting in the 1950s, when new research came along showing different neurotransmitters in the brain and so on. And so they developed a drug called Stelazine, which they gave initially to a lot of people who were suffering from various mental illnesses. And this tended to mollify them and calm them down and create them as more malleable subjects to be controlled, so there wouldn't be as much trouble in the mental institution or to their surroundings, the people in their surroundings, family, friends, etc., etc. So Stelazine became this very popular drug that they would give to people, and they started calling it the initial tranquilizer. My one of my teachers in London, Dr. John Heaton, who wrote books on the eye, as well as books on Wittgenstein and various forms of psychoanalysis, pointed out that these drugs were not just tranquilizers, they were actually tractabilizers. If they gave them to people or to animals in laboratory settings, they found that these animals or people could be more easily conditioned to behave in certain ways. So they made people more tractable, more willing to be told what to do. After this invention of Stelazine, the world of psychiatry and microbiology, neurobiology, went on to develop all sorts of other psychiatric drugs, including Haldol and various others that are now given to people classed as schizophrenics. So instead of locking people up in mental institutions, they can give them a shot of this drug and send them out in the streets. And it's instead of having to tie them up in a real straitjacket, they can give them this kind of chemical straitjacket, which keeps them under control. Now, I particularly wouldn't want to have to go through that. If I found myself freaking out and unable to deal with life and unable to deal with the world around me, I wouldn't want to be pumped full of any kind of drugs. I'd rather take my chances. And by speaking to people, whether it's a therapist or friends or a priest or rabbi, rather than be given a chemical straitjacket. But some people swear by these drugs, and there are numerous ones of them. Cancel that. Some people swear by these drugs and are happy to take them to help them lead a more quote-unquote normal life. That's their choice. Clearly they do work on certain neurotransmitters and make behavioral changes, but whether that's something you want to do as part of discovering your own truth, that's another story. So here we return again to the idea of truth and what truth can do for one. So taking all these therapies and all these different methodologies that I've briefly touched upon in this talk, one can divide them really into the ones that are involve self-reflection and understanding oneself better, and methods that are used to control one's thoughts, behavior, one's biochemistry from some outside source as prescribed by an expert. Which would you rather have? So, thank you for listening. That's a little bit about truth, about social and general and political truth through philosophy, and about finding your own personal truth through psychotherapy, or what we call philosophical consulting. And hopefully, through finding more truth and finding out the truth of yourself, you can live a more fulfilled and happy life, free of illusions and the pains of ignorance. You can experience the joy and fulfillment of living an authentic life and not one based on illusion. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to me. Or if you'd like to arrange a personal consultation, my email is murray@livingphilosophy.org. And the website is www.livingphilosophy.org. Thank you.